Welcome to Politics and Science. This week I'm featuring an interview with Dr. Henry H. Bauer. He's Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Science Studies, Dean Emeritus of Arts and Sciences at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. Professor Bauer is a science historian, and we're talking today about the state and health of our science culture in the 21st century. This was recorded on May 17th, 2011. Well, welcome to Politics and Science. I'm John Barkhausen, and I appreciate you coming on today. My guest is Professor Henry Bauer, who's, correct me if this is wrong, Dean Emeritus of Arts and Sciences and Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Science Studies at Virginia Tech.
Quite right.
And how long have you been there?
I came to Tech in 1978 as dean, and I retired at the end of 99.
I see. So you've been there quite a while.
Yeah, longer than anywhere else.
Yeah, and you've been you were born in Europe, is that right?
Yeah, I was born in Vienna, and we got out in 1939. Shortly after the Germans took over. And I lived in Australia until 1965.
Yeah, I detect the Australian accent.
Yes, there's a bit of it there.
So, this is a big subject. You're become quite the critic of how science is conducted in this age that we're living in. In fact, I thought I'd open up the conversation with a pretty interesting quote. You said it's widely known that President Eisenhower had warned of the dangers of a military-industrial complex. Much less known is that Eisenhower was just as insightful and prescient about the dangers from big science. And I quote, you quoting Eisenhower, "In holding scientific research and discovery in respect, we must also be alert to the danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite." And Professor Bauer, you think that's actually come to pass?
I do. I think it has happened. And somehow or other, the science, or the spokespeople for science, have attained such a reputation in society that we go along with what they say, even when the evidence is not there for it. What I've been most involved in, actually, in the last half a dozen years, stems from the realization that popular view of HIV as a cause of AIDS actually lacks any evidence at all. And nevertheless, it has been the standard belief for a long time.
Yes, in fact, I don't really know whether it's true or not, but I've of course assumed it's true because that's reinforced over and over again in every story you hear. Even if it's not about AIDS itself, it might be just a side issue, but every time you hear a mention of AIDS and HIV, of course, you're linking the two together.
Right, right.
So if that's the case with AIDS, it's probably true of a lot of other issues as well, that where science interfaces with public policy.
I think the one that may be most surprising to people is global warming. There is no doubt that the globe is warming up, but there's no good evidence that it is human activity or the burning of fossil fuels that is doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to upset a whole other bunch of people, because many people think that our life on Earth is threatened by the warming of the planet, and that if we don't do something about our fossil fuel consumption, that And if we don't have a reason to do something about it, like scientific reason, we're going to be in serious trouble.
And I think that point illustrates, I think, one reason why these things gain such a following, and that is that people concerned with the environment overall seized on the notion of global warming because science is behind it, and it enables people to really press strongly about other environmental issues as well. Mm-hmm. In other words, there are many reasons why one would like to stop the burning of fossil fuels, and people concerned with the environment have put forward a number of those, but none of them is really as captivating as the thought that we're heating things up to the extent that the ice caps are melting and seas will arise and cities will be flooded.
Mm-hmm. And of course, when science is used to justify public policy, it's also used by industry to fit into their agendas that they're trying to promote, such as a nuclear power, which is an industry that I consider to be somewhat suicidal, if not completely suicidal. And they're, of course, using global warming to justify their continuation.
You know, one of the real difficulties of talking and writing about these things is that it's so hard to avoid describing the situation as though it was a sort of deliberate conspiracy. And I don't think that's the case. Industries and businesses are very properly looking to making as much in the way of profit and expanding as far as possible. And people working for those places are very properly looking for ways to do that. I don't think it occurs to most people that they may be closing their eyes to quite strong evidence that what they're doing causes a great deal of damage and is unwarranted in many ways.
Hmm.
So, I mean, it would be much easier, I think, to gather support to change things if you could point to people who are deliberate wrongdoers. But the problem is that we've got a whole host of misguided, well-intentioned people. There's a lot of criticism nowadays, and I think very properly so, of the influence that lobbyists and industry through lobbyists have on Congress. And yet I doubt that there are many people inside Congress who see themselves as doing anything wrong.
Yeah, I'm sure that everybody, for the most part, is well-intentioned, and even when they are serving their own personal needs, they probably are able to rationalize that it's serving a greater cause as well.
Yeah, and it's common to believe that if you want to have an influence on something, you've got to be on the inside. Well, to be on the inside in Congress, you have to get elected. Mm-hmm. To get elected, you need to raise a lot of money, and so it goes.
Yeah. Well, Professor Bauer, we're talking about some things that are probably could be shocking quite a few people. I think most people think that HIV causes AIDS, and I think most people, at least that I associate with generally in life, believe that global warming is being caused by man's activities. And before we go into the specifics maybe of those issues, maybe you could talk a little bit more generally about how this could be possibly happening, that we could all be so sure that this is the reality that we're facing from our basically we've been informed by our our scientists and our scientific press that this is the reality, but how is it that we're not hearing the contrary evidence, and how did we get here?
One of the ways we got here was that science got tremendous public prestige and status because of the atom bomb project in the Second World War. And after the Second World War, a tremendous amount of resources were put into science on the belief that if that happened, then good things for society would be bound to follow. One of the earliest was the idea that nuclear power for peaceful purposes would solve energy problems. But the National Science Foundation was established after the Second World War, and tremendous expansion of funds for the National Institutes of Health. And so the scientific and medical research enterprises really expanded enormously. They expanded more than resources were available. One of the important things about the history of science is that science really expanded in volume exponentially since about the 17th century. A number of measures of that, the number of journals, number of articles published, number of people you could call scientists, doubled about every 15 years, which is an extraordinary thing when it goes on over about 300 years. And the man who first noted this, Derek Price, pointed out that by the middle of the 20th century, about 2 to 3% of gross domestic product was being used on research and development. And he pointed out that you couldn't continue to double that. And he said there would be a crisis. And there are several signs of those of crisis. One of them, that about 30 years ago, for the first time, questions of fraud in science became important. There were some very public instances where people supposedly doing science were just faking results. We've got a situation the last few decades where there are more people wanting to do research than there are available resources, and so you've got cutthroat competition. One sign of that, I think, one consequence of that, is that people have become less willing to hear disagreement with their views. The people who got into positions of influence in journals and scientific associations are not very inclined to allow minority views to be heard. And so you have a situation where when something captures the opinions of spokespeople, then the general public and the policy makers go along with that. They don't know that there are other views. In the case of global warming, for example, thousands of climatologists and meteorologists and physicists and so on have signed several petitions asking for a review of the evidence, and yet I doubt that many people are even aware of that because the media don't publicize it.
No, I never heard that.
Well, there is a website, for instance, that is sepp.org, which was established by Fred Singer, who He's an emeritus from the University of Virginia and George Mason University, a climatologist with a very distinguished record. And his website is full of information about those petitions and about conferences that people hold. You know, dissidents from the mainstream view. And Singer has written at least one book with the charming title of Human-Caused Global Warming Every 1,500 Years,
mm-hmm.
To emphasize one of the main points made by people with his viewpoint, that there have been very large cyclical variations in global temperature over the years. At any rate, I think that increased dogmatism, which I think is in large part the result of cutthroat competition and unwillingness of established individuals to allow other viewpoints to be heard, I think that's a very large part of the present problem.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because it makes science sound more like a war of PR firms, public relations firms, trying to get the catchiest theory out there to capture the public's attention. And then once they do, they don't let go, because they're probably their grants and their prestige all rest on keeping that ball rolling.
Exactly. And I've cited several times recently, George Bernard Shaw once said that all professions are conspiracies against the laity. And I think that's now true of the scientific professions and the medical professions.
In the sense that they're speaking a code or in such esoteric language?
Again, it's not that they're deliberate conspiracies, but they amount to actions that are not in the best interests of the public. The point being that if you're a doctor, then you quite rightly are concerned to that your profession be respected and valued and so on. And so any criticism of it, you're likely to try to brush off if you can. In terms of the state of medicine, one of the most important factors is the way in which the drug companies have come to exert influence everywhere. And one of the extraordinary things to me is the number of exposés that have been published by prominent insiders without it having any effect at all. For example, Marcia Angel, a former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, published a book half a dozen years ago entitled How the Drug Companies Deceive Us. And in an article in the New York Review of Books not that long ago, she said that nowadays you cannot trust anything that is said by official bodies about medicine or medical science. Now, you know, that's an extraordinary sort of thing to be said by someone in her position, but she's far from the only one. Another former editor of that journal, Cassirer, published a book along the same lines. And there are a whole host of others. And yet the media don't pay much attention to it, certainly not enough attention that any public action could follow from that.
That's perplexing. Why do you think the media doesn't pick up on that? Because that's an astounding statement.
The media have their own problems because they also are in the business of making money. So they have to attend to what advertisers like. And drug advertising is an enormous part of I mean, you just have to turn on television and you see how much of the advertising comes from drug companies who are touting products that they want you to ask your doctor about.
I see. So everybody has a conflict of interest going, and it means they're not really doing their public service.
Exactly. And there is a whole host of books about how overtreated and overdosed with medications we are in the United States. There's one I read recently by Jeremy Green called Prescribing by Numbers, which relates how we have gone from going to a doctor when we're sick and the doctor asking about symptoms and looking for things evidently wrong. We've gone to a situation where perfectly healthy people get lab tests done and then are told, well, you have a bit of hypertension, or you are pre-diabetic, or something along those lines, and then they're put on long-term medication.
Yeah, that's scary.
Well, it's not only scary, it's terribly harmful, because any drug, that anything you take that isn't natural to the body and that you take for 10, 20, 30, and 40 years is likely to have some unfortunate so-called side effects. Another little known secret about drugs is that there's really no such thing apparently as a drug that doesn't have unwanted effects. And one of the things that illustrates that is the process that the industry calls drug repositioning, which means that once they've had a drug approved for a certain purpose, they then look for other possible uses for it.
Ah.
Now, and that tells you immediately that it's quite common for substances to have more than the initially desired effect, that the other effects can be so strong that you can actually reposition the drug to treat something else. And the advantage of that process, of course, is that once you've had a drug approved, it has been said to be safe. And so if you want to have it approved for a different purpose, it's much cheaper to do so because you don't have to do the safety trials again.
Ah, I getcha.
Yeah.
So they save money on the next approval, and it's already a product they've paid the money to make.
Right, and I think that illustrates what I said about things not being a conscious conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these things are discussed perfectly openly. Articles are published about the benefits of, the financial benefits of drug repositioning. And, you know, so the people doing this seem to be unaware that they're really showing that there's something seriously wrong about things, that drugs that are sold for specific purposes are not particularly specific.
Now, all this drug testing, to approve these drugs, they have to be tested, and the testing is being done by laboratories, I assume, that probably, are they university labs?
Well, the trials are funded and controlled by the drug companies.
Oh.
Yeah, 15 or 20 years ago, Congress decided that the FDA didn't need so much money that they could charge fees from the drug companies. Now, this brings in potential conflicts of interest immediately. And there's a whole new industry that was set up called contract research organizations who are employed by drug companies to carry out clinical trials. Again, you've got conflicts of interest. A contract research organization knows that it is unlikely to continue to get work from a particular company if they too often find that their products are really no good.
Yeah, that seems really problematic. That, of course, you'd need to have almost anonymous labs doing the testing.
Yeah.
And some firewall between the...
Exactly, and that's one of the things that Marcia Angel in her critical book said, that there is a dire need for an independent, publicly funded institute to actually look at and analyze the results of clinical trials.
You've written about the scientific method, and I think many of us in the lay science community, have faith that the scientific method will eventually find the truth about our reality. Can you comment on that?
Yes, there is no such thing as a scientific method.
And how can that be?
If by that you mean an approach that is used by all scientists. Textbooks describe the scientific method as setting up a hypothesis, setting up tests of the hypothesis, carrying out the tests, and accepting or rejecting the results so that either a theory is proved or disproved. That's far too simplified, but one point that is central there is that the results of tests are very rarely unambiguous. Human interpretation enters into it. Before that, the design of a test depends on human ingenuity. And in point of fact, there are very few scientists who even think of proceeding that way. Mostly people just have hunches that if they do a certain thing or try some things, then something useful will show up. And beyond that, very few of the people who would be called scientists are even trying to test theories. I mean, most people doing even research just accept what the current beliefs are, and then they try to do useful things on the basis of those beliefs, accepting those beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
A great part of the literature on history of science is illustrates how much trial and error there has been in the history of science, and how luck comes into making real advances and real discoveries.
That's interesting, because I always think of, you know, science over the years has built a structure of knowledge that the next generation of scientists can then build on. But you're saying that we've sort of gone off on a bunch of limbs that perhaps have no basis in reality.
Well, the matter of time comes into it. The scientific knowledge is very unreliable when it first comes out of a lab. And over the years, the part of it that is reliable is slowly separated out. In my book about the scientific method, I call it a knowledge filter.
Mm.
And it takes time for that filtering to take place as people try to build on what other people have claimed. John Zeeman, who was a physicist, a prominent physicist, fellow of the Royal Society, turned to history and philosophy of science, and he said that probably 90% of what is in the physics research literature turns out to be wrong. This is just the way in which science progresses, is by continually finding that what we thought is not right. Now, it's not necessarily totally wrong, but if you were to compare textbooks of 100 years ago with now, there's a lot in those older textbooks that has been simply superseded and that we no longer believe.
Mm-hmm.
That's progress.
Yeah, and it sounds like from what you're saying that it doesn't mean that those textbooks, some of the, what they say are necessarily wrong, even though we've discarded it too, that perhaps we've gone off and to dead ends or...
Yeah, one of the talks I gave some time ago was called "Real Science Isn't News," because most people think of real science as something that you can trust.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't trust anything that has been just discovered, because there are too many possibilities that there's something wrong with the discovery, with the claimed discovery. Unfortunately, the media are interested in the latest, the newest. And so you've got really, people are flooded with so-called scientific information, which is highly unreliable. Because the media generally don't seem to regard it as that they would get an audience if they had more analytical or perspective type coverage of science. So what you read about are things like, we've discovered a gene that causes breast cancer. Well, when that was first touted 10 or 15 years ago, you can imagine how many women in particular, felt that soon they wouldn't have to worry about that anymore. So then over the years, it turned out that this so-called breast cancer gene is associated with maybe 5% of breast cancers, which is not very good.
No.
And what's more, not everyone who has that gene is going to get the cancer.
So that seems almost meaningless.
Yes. But that, after that had been touted, women were having prophylactic mastectomy.
Oh, God.
And that still goes on, of course.
Yeah, because these things all have a momentum of their own, and once they get basically embedded in the public psyche, it's hard to change course.
Right. A friend of mine, Joel Kaufman, retired organic chemist, published a book called Malignant Medical Myths. It has had an excellent reception, strangely enough. I don't know how much effect it's had on general practice, but the sort of thing that he found when looking into the original literature everybody says or thinks that taking an aspirin a day protects against heart attacks. What the literature says is that that's only the case if you have already had a heart attack. Now, that's a very, very different thing.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, which also Jeremy Green in Prescribing by Numbers points out, the data that accumulated over decades shows that it is normal for blood pressure to increase with age. And when these data were first being discussed, some cardiologists even pointed out there may be an excellent reason for that, because arteries become less flexible,
mm-hmm.
and so you need more pressure to send the blood out to the extremities. However, the definition of hypertension is set at a level of blood pressure that normally, on average, is reached at age 55 or 60. In other words, under the present regime, a huge number of people aged 55 or 60 or above are taking various medications intended to lower their blood pressure, when there's really no good evidence that that is beneficial. Same thing with cholesterol and statins. Kaufman's book has some data which shows that above age 70, the higher your cholesterol is, the longer your expected lifespan.
Yeah, I've heard that from other sources too.
Yeah.
That it's actually doing something therapeutic.
Well, I mean, cholesterol is manufactured in the body because it plays a very important function in the membranes of all of our cells, for example. So, you know, I can't find a really satisfying, certainly no simple explanation for how we got into the present situation. But a big part of it has to be the way in which things have become so dogmatic that it takes forever for minority views to be paid proper attention, so that we can go off on a wrong tack for a very long time.
Well, one thing you did mention in your articles, which I should, we're talking to a Professor Henry H. Bauer, who's Dean Emeritus of Arts and Sciences and Professor Emeritus of Chemistry and Science Studies at Virginia Tech. And he has an excellent website, which I believe, if I can bring that up here, is henrybauer.homestead.com. That's Henry Bauer, Homestead.
Henry H. Bauer.
Oh, thank you. Henry H. Bauer. .homestead.com, where there's a lot of interesting articles. And one of those articles, you were talking about something called Parkinson's Law, I think it was called.
Yes.
I think how we got into this mess may be just the nature of the size of our organizations at this point. Maybe you could explain that. It has to do with bureaucracies.
Yeah, Parkinson's Law is often quoted as work expands to fill the time available.
Uh-huh.
But Parkinson's wrote actually several amusing books 40 or 50 years ago. And one of the things that he said was that when an institution has really become reached very high status and prestige, that's the point at which it starts to become obsolete, but that isn't noticed for a long time. And the example he gives is of the British Royal Navy, which by the end of the First World War was just all-powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years it accumulated more and more bureaucracy and became more and more dysfunctional. And I think that that is one way of looking at what has happened to science. It has become very bureaucratic. I think the popular view of scientists is still that you have these highly intelligent, self-motivated people who are individually having great ideas and trying them out and pushing progress ahead. That is not such a bad picture of what was happening up to the early part of the 20th century. Nowadays, you have enormous interconnected facilities where in order to get your own ideas tested, you may have to assemble huge teams of people. You have to become a manager or a bureaucrat. One illustration of that is that you find many articles now which have hundreds of authors. Now think about that. In particle physics, you may have a two-page article in Science with 300 authors on it.
Wow.
You know that there are not very many people who have actually been able to contribute to the essential intellectual stuff there. So a lot of people who are doing science now are really employees. They're cogs in the machine.
It sounds like a factory almost.
Exactly. And when you have a bureaucracy, no matter what it's about, a bureaucracy has great inertia. You've got these huge facilities like the International Particle Physics Establishment in Switzerland. The investment in that is enormous on the part of different countries, and of course the careers of everyone there is invested in it. How would it ever be possible to even entertain the notion that they're on the wrong track?
Yeah, that would be disastrous to all of their careers and jobs.
Yeah. The greatest shock so far along those lines came a few years ago, because the United States physics community had originally got Congress to approve building such a facility in the States, in Texas. And the original estimate was that it would only cost about $2 billion to build it. After a few years, it had already cost $6 or $8 billion, and Congress finally called a halt to it and decided to support that international facility instead.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an enormous shock to the physics community that for the very first time it had seemed that that money was an object.
I see. Yeah, it's interesting that we do have such a belief in progress, and I think that in part comes out of maybe a natural optimism, but also maybe from this, what you describe as scientism, where we believe so much that the next invention coming down the road is going to somehow save us.
Yes. And, you know, the National Institutes of Health now commands a budget of tens of billions of dollars. If you want to be to have a career in biological research in academe, you must get grants. Universities expect it. Nowadays, you simply cannot have a research career unless you're also an entrepreneur who brings in money. Now, the pressure to do that means that you've got to start publishing really early, And this is one of the reasons why the incidence of fraud has gone up. People attempted to cut corners. They need to get this article out now. So they put down the results that they know they're going to get rather than waiting until they've gotten them.
Yikes. Yeah. Which is called cheating, right?
Which is called cheating. The first major book about this was in about 1980 by a couple of science journalists, Broad and Wade. The book was called Betrayers of the Truth.
Hmm.
And at that time, around 1980, I was incensed when I read that book because they were saying that fraud was an inherent part of science. And, you know, I didn't believe that. I was captivated by science and studied chemistry, and I did research in chemistry and taught it for until the mid-1970s. And I was quite idealistic about it. I still am, actually. I'm just terribly disillusioned about the way things have gone. But at any rate, Broad and Wade had noticed the increasing incidence of fakery and fraud. Most of it, actually, in medically related areas.
Yeah. And that's they published that, it looks like, almost 30 years ago.
That's right.
So the trend probably hasn't improved.
It has quite the opposite. One important thing that happened, I think, in the 1990s was that the director of the National Institutes of Health allowed senior members of NIH to accept consultancies with drug companies. Think about it. People who are in charge of the government program that is supposed to monitor whether a drug is any good or not are also consulting for the company that is producing that drug.
Yeah, that doesn't sound, that doesn't look good, and it doesn't sound good.
No, and there was a series of articles by David Willman in Los Angeles Times, I think around 2003, which exposed these conflicts of interest and some of their consequences, and some of the people resigned, and Congress appointed the most recent director, I've forgotten, of NIH, tried very hard to do something about these conflicts of interest. But at any rate, that was an important milestone in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and that really undermines the public's trust.
Right. Another milestone, I think also in the early 1990s, was when the Food and Drug Administration permitted drug companies to do general advertising of prescription drugs to the public. I doubt that there are many people who know that that used to be not permitted. And the United States and New Zealand are the only two civilized countries that allow it. Up to that time, most of the drug advertising had been direct to the medical profession. And that was a very different sort of situation than you have now, where doctors are being continually asked by their patients, you know, do you think it would be a good idea for me to try this?
Yeah.
And
that's the adult equivalent of putting the candy down where the children can see it in the supermarket.
Exactly. And if you pay attention to some of these ads, they are required to mention nasty possible side effects. And I've marveled at the ability of people to describe those side effects in such sunny voices, as though you would almost love to have that happen to you.
Yeah, that's right. And also at about twice or three times the normal talking speed.
Yes, yes.
The verbal equivalent of small print.
Exactly.
Well, believe it or not, we're actually, the show has been speeding by, and we are talking to Professor Henry H. Bauer, and we're talking about the troubles with science in this day and age and how we got here.
Let me mention that I have a book that's going to be coming out this year.
Yeah, that's great.
Called
Do That.
Dogmatism in Science and Medicine.
Okay.
And it gives a great deal of detail, of course, about largely about what we've been talking about. I don't know when it's coming out. I delivered the manuscript long ago, and it's going to be some months yet because I haven't seen the copy edited material yet.
All right. Well, if you're willing, I would love to do another show based around that book. It sounds like a very relevant and interesting title.
Well, I certainly plan to send you an email when it's out.
Okay, great. You had a great quote by Jacob Bronowski.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember it offhand, or should I read it?
Please read it. My memory is not the best anymore.
Okay. It was about dogmatism, and it sort of puts
It
mm-hmm. puts it in perspective. Bronowski is squatting next to a pond at Auschwitz. He scoops from it a handful of ashes and muses, "Into this pond were flushed the ashes of some 4 million people. And that was not done by gas. It was done by arrogance. It was done by dogma. It was done by ignorance. When people believe that they have absolute knowledge with no test in reality, this is how they behave. This is what men do when they aspire to the knowledge of gods." And I think that quote does embody the consequences of what happens when mankind goes forward with no basis in reality.
Yeah.
It can be very serious. And it sounds like at this point, from your assessment of the function of science in our society now, there's probably some good science still being done, but we're not necessarily hearing about it, and it certainly doesn't seem to be used as the basis for our public policy decisions.
Yeah, public policy is not being based on the best available evidence, and after all, that's the case in economics too, isn't it?
Yeah, it does apply to a lot of other fields as well.
You know, I mean, it's sort of disheartening to see everyone agreeing that the debt limit must be raised and the deficit must be brought down, and yet what we have are ideological squabbles about it instead of anything sensible.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you could sum up a little bit, Professor Bauer, by talking about what do you think we should do to begin to reform how science is conducted.
John Zeiman is a fellow who I think understands what has happened particularly well, and he pointed out that what we've gone from an era where scientists could be said to behave as individual entrepreneurs to one where they are largely beholden to patrons or to employers. And he says the problem is somehow to find space for people to do their own thing. In other words, judging what is likely to bring the best, most reliable knowledge, rather than having to deliver what is being asked for. You know, we've generally gotten away from taking long-term perspectives. It used to be that many industries had research labs where people were allowed a great deal of freedom with the belief that eventually they would be producing things that could be applied, could be exploited. And those labs have gone by the board. Bell Telephone Labs were famous. They brought things like the transistor and the laser. But that meant that the businesses had to be supporting people for long periods of time without them seeming to produce anything tangible. So somehow we've got to find some way in which people are allowed to look to the longer term again rather than to the shorter term. And one of the things that's necessary, I believe, is to make science smaller. We don't need as many people doing research now as we have. We don't need as many universities that try to be research universities as we have. I can't see any other way out of the present situation where there are too many people fighting over too few resources, and as a result, short-term objectives take precedence over everything else. My friend Jack Good used to like to say that the urgent drives out the important. And I think we really see that happening.
Yeah, that's a good quote. That makes sense in everyday life and for science. Well, I'd love to talk more, but I'm afraid we've run out of time, and it's been very enjoyable to talk to you, Henry Bauer, Professor Henry Bauer. I seem to have lost the sheet I had your credentials on. Could you give those?
My affiliation? Yeah, I'm retired from Virginia Tech. I was Dean of Arts and Sciences and also a Professor of Chemistry and Science Studies.
Thanks so much, Professor Bauer. I hope to continue this conversation very soon.
Thanks very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Politics and Science. That was Professor Henry H. Bauer, B-A-U-E-R. You can find out more about his work at henryhbauer.homestead.com. Podcasts of this show, Politics and Science, can be found at radio4all.net. That's radio4all.net. The preceding show did represent the viewpoints of its participants and does not necessarily represent an official opinion of any other person or organization. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned next week for another episode of Politics and Science.